Everybody, and welcome to this week's Midrash on the Triennial Torah Portion Readings, which this week comes from Genesis chapter 32, verse 3 through chapter 33, verse 17, Obadiah chapter 1, verse 1, Psalm 27, and from the Brit Hadashah, James chapter 1, verses 1 through 12. And helping us in our studies this week in discussion, Mark Petrone of Fulfilling Torah Ministries. I'm going to begin by reading the beginning verses, Genesis chapter 32, verse 3 through verse 12. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is Elohim's host," and he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother under the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, "Thus shall you speak unto my lord Esau. Your servant Jacob saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen and donkeys, flocks, men servants and women servants. And I have sent to tell my lord that I might find grace in your sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he comes to meet you, and 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. And he divided the people that was with him, and the flocks, and the herds, and the camels, into two bands, and said, "If Esau come to the one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape." And Jacob said, "O Elohim of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, Yahweh, which said unto me, Return unto your kindred and to your country, and I will deal with you. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies of all the truth which you showed unto your servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I have become two bands. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And thou saidst, I will surely do you good and make your seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured for multitude." Mark, would you like to share and make comment regarding these verses?
Yeah, your eyeballs weren't working too well because that said numbered for multitude, not measured. But it's neither here nor there. Shalom, everybody. Just thought I'd give Eddie a hard time.
Soften up.
just gotta soften up the audience here. Okay, Genesis 32, 3 through 12. Yaakov and Pham are at a place called Mahanaim, which is two hosts. The two hosts are Yaakov's family and Yahweh's hosts that met him in verse 1. With this backup, Yahweh's hosts, Yaakov seems to have the guts to face Esau, but not so much that he's unworried, and he begins to send emissaries to soften his brother up. He humbles himself before Esau before he even sends his servants by calling Esau his lord and referring to himself as Esau's servant. He tells his servants to tell Esau that he's been away and is returning home and would like to live there in peace. The quote from the King James is, "that I might find grace in thy sight," which means, "I want you to like me." This is what is happening right now in Israel and has been for 60 years. Yaakov is trying to get Esau to like him. There are two chances of that happening, slim and none. Yaakov understands how difficult this would be when his servants return to tell him that Esau is coming to welcome him home with about 400 of his closest friends in battle array. This has been the pattern throughout history, as can be seen in Numbers chapter 20 and verse 20, where Edom refuses Israel passage and comes out against Israel in full combat gear, and again in the return from Babylon in Nehemiah and Ezra, and again in the establishment of the secular Zionist state of Israel in 1947. Esau does not want Israel in the land and never has, since Yaakov finagled the blessing from Yitzhak. Esau wants Yaakov dead. I think that one of the reasons the Edomite Muslims hate America so much is that they know better than we do that we are the bright, shining city on a hill. Just an aside, did you know that the only city described as a city on the hill in the King James is Samaria, and that the root for Samaria is Shamar, to guard. That's just an aside. Thought I'd let you in on that. By the way, you can find that reference in 1 Kings 16 and 24. So Jake divides the family into two bands, Mahanaim, so that Esau might miss some of them in his zeal to kill the other. Then, and only then, does he resort to Yahweh for protection of both hosts. First, by reminding Yahweh of his promise to deal well with him in the land, in verse 9. Then, by humbling himself before Yahweh and thanking him for his grace to date, in verse 10. And only then, by making a supplication, in verse 11. Now, I could be wrong about this.
But we doubt it.
Okay, but we doubt it. But I think that we have here an excellent example of how we should approach Yahweh with our supplications. We ought to, 1, be sure that our request is righteous. 2, remind him of his promises to us. 3, acknowledge our sinfulness and our need for his gracious protection. 4, ask him for his favor in granting our needs and desires. And then, 5, remind him again of his promise. In verse 10, he makes mention of the two hosts that Yahweh has blessed him to become. These two bands can be seen as the two sheepfolds in the stars. Remember, we've spoken about the gospel in the stars. In the constellation Pisces, I think, I really could be wrong about this, but there are representations of two fish. They're called the two sheepfolds in the Hebrew Dendera, one swimming celestial north and the other swimming celestial east along the ecliptic, both tied by a band to the foot of Cetus, the sea monster. The northbound fish is the larger of the two, as Ephraim is the larger of the sheepfolds, and was carried off to the north. Yehuda, the smaller of the fish, or the sheepfolds, was carried away by Babylon, to the east. I think it is Perseus, I'm not sure about that, the other constellation in this group of constellations, I think it's Perseus who is standing with his sword, ready to cut the bands tying the sheepfolds to the sea monster. This is Moshiach, cutting that which ties the two houses to Hasatan and setting us free. It is very interesting to me, at least, that when a star map is overlaid on a globe with Jerusalem as the center of the earth, meaning that the equator runs through Jerusalem and so does the prime meridian, and so you divide east and west at Jerusalem, and you divide north and south at Jerusalem, that the sheepfolds are laid over Assyria and Babylon respectively, and the bands conjoin over Jerusalem. Scripture says that Jerusalem is the center of the earth. I just can't remember the reference, but by the way, I found the reference. It's in Ezekiel, and I think it's in chapter 33. I'm not certain about that. I thought I changed it in here, but it didn't change on my laptop here. Anyway, this would mean to me that it is the right place for the equator and the prime meridian, the division between east, west, and north, south. Notice at the end of verse 11 that Yaakov is thinking more of Rachel and Joseph than the others when he said the mother, singular, of the children, not the mothers of the children. I don't think it was intentional, but just his nature. He always favored Rachel, even when he didn't realize he was doing so. In Genesis 32, verses 13 let's stop there and we'll do questions and comments and then we'll move on from there.
Questions, thoughts, comments in Pal Talk Land.
A couple of things. Ecclesiastes, we read in 10:4, if the spirit of the ruler rise up against you, leave not your place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. In other words, if you are in the right, stand firm in truth, for that will set you free. And that's what he had to do here. In Proverbs it says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. And I think that this was the goal of what Jacob was trying to do here. He was trying to take care of this problem here. Now, I believe Jacob really was afraid. And I think the character of him before his encounter with the man that we have later, the man, after which he became Israel and he walked in that light. But even if he was afraid, he did a smart thing. He did split the camp. Now, I could be wrong here, Eddie, But what I see is Leah, who was the mother of whom? Judah went into the land first. And Rebecca, who was the mother of Ephraim, came in, Rachel came in second. Is this not a picture of the last days? What is going to happen?
Genesis 33, verse 2.
So you have this scenario here that I never saw before, that the two houses are here, and they are split, just like Mark has said. But here they come into the land, and they're coming in of the pattern. This is a type and a pattern of what was going to happen. And in verse 9 through 12, I believe that this is the first recorded example of prayer that's in the Bible. And of course, the appeal is to Yahweh as to standing in covenant relationship to His family. See, He took Yahweh to task and said, "We have a covenant relationship. We have something." And of course, later we see that He does put action to His prayer. He will put action to His prayer. And and also it talks about the cattle that He gave and the sheep and so forth, the mention of it. It was 550 head, was very much prized, although later we see the example what happened there. But the thing that was the most prized was the camels, the 30 camels. They were the most prized of everything. There's 30 of them. But the she camels formed the principal part of the Arabs' wealth. And that was very important to them.
Something that just came to mind, Bill. I wonder if you might think that the 30 camels might be a reference to 30 pieces of silver in the price.
I did think of that, but I wasn't certain. I didn't mention it because I thought of that, the 30 pieces of silver that He was given as like a blood offering. You know, it was that's what the 30 pieces of silver were. And
like perhaps He was purchasing His freedom from His brother,
right,
by giving Him 30 camels.
30,
right. Just came to mind a minute ago.
Now that was thought of, but I didn't put it down because I thought, no, that can't be. But you know, you're right; it probably is. But that's what I have.
Well, let me give you my thoughts on this so far. We got to go back and get the context. Genesis chapter 31, verse 2: Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not toward him as before. And so this is what precipitated Yahweh telling Jacob in verse 3, "Return to the land of your fathers and of your kindred, and I will be with you." There is a principle that before the people of the God of Israel get told to leave where they're at, things have to change in the land regarding the attitude of the people of Yahweh. Anyone who's been living in America for the last 20, 30 years knows the attitude toward Judeo-Christian faith has changed dramatically as influenced by Hollywood, the media, and the courts. That is a sign that our days in this land are numbered. Because ultimately, we see that as a precondition for the people of Yahweh being told to return to the land. We see the setting in Exodus in chapter 1, verse 8. "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who knew not Joseph." And that's what preceded the persecution of the children of Israel in Egypt. A Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. Somebody who didn't respect the God of Israel. Didn't respect the people who believed in the God of Israel. And what comes following that is affliction, persecution, and bondage of the people of the God of Israel. And it's in that setting that Yahweh says to His people, "Return to the land of your fathers and I will be with you." Now, Jacob had served Laban for 20 years, as we're told in Genesis 31 and verse 41. We have the principle that the things that happened to the forefathers are prophecies of what happened to their descendants. So when Jacob returns to the land, he meets up with Esau. That is a prophecy that in the end of days, the tribulation is about a battle between Jacob and Esau. And Jacob would seek to make peace with Esau and offer him his material substance for peace, because Jacob offers oxen and donkey, flocks, men servants and women servants to make peace with Esau. However, Esau isn't interested in making peace with Jacob. He's interested in war. That's why he brings with him 400 men. So what's Israel talking in the peace process? Peace. Here, I got land, I got holy sites, you know, whatever you want, I'll give it to you. Just let me live my life. But what do the Palestinians come with? Guns. 400 men. And prophetically, that tells us that this results in Jacob being, in Genesis 32:7, afraid and distressed. Afraid and distressed. It's from Jacob being greatly afraid and distressed is what Jeremiah picks up in Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7, referring to the end of days as Jacob's trouble. Now, when the land of Israel gets divided, as we're told in the book of Joel, there's a prayer that is to be prayed by the people of Yahweh, and that is to remember the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Joel chapter 2, verse 17. Let the priests, the ministers of Yahweh, weep between the porch and the altar, and let them say, "Spare your people, O Yahweh, give not your heritage to reproach. Spare your people, give not your heritage to reproach." So it is a prayer on behalf of the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So how does Jacob pray here? According to the promise that was made to him by Yeshua the Messiah. And in Genesis 32, verse 13, verse 11, it says, "Deliver me from Esau. As you said, I will do you good and make your seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for a multitude." So he's making a reference to what was said to him in Genesis chapter 28 and verses 13 through 15, where it says, "And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, I am the Yahweh Elohim of Abraham your father, the Elohim of Isaac. The land where you lie, to you will I give it, and to your seed. And your seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west, the east, the north, and the south. And in you and in your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with you and will keep you in all places where you go, and will bring you again into this land, for I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken to you of." That is the promise to the exiles of Israel. I will not forsake you, and I will do that which I have promised, which is to bring you back to the land. And so we see the principle that which happens to the forefathers happens to the descendants. That's what I have to share through verse 12. Anybody here in the congregation or in Pow Talk have any further thoughts, questions, comments regarding Genesis chapter 32, verses 3 through 12? Anybody in the congregation or in Pow Talk have any thoughts, questions, comments? Ron, go ahead.
Yes, I looked at the number 400 men, and I thought, are there any other places in Scripture where we can find the 400? And I just noticed this morning as Eddie was talking that Israel was supposed to be down in the land of Egypt for 400 years, or at least, as we find out, it was actually divided from the time of Isaac's birth until they actually came forth from Egypt. But then also, David had 400 men that worked with him when he was in the wilderness, and then he was fleeing from Saul. And then I found it interesting as well in that Elijah fought 400 prophets of Baal, in the sense that there was a contest on Mount Carmel with regards to who was truly Elohim. And of course, he was victorious, one man and Elohim against 400 prophets of Baal, and he actually slaughtered them all in that particular contest. And as far as there were 400 virgins mentioned in regards to when Benjamin was disciplined, and most of them were killed. Other than that, I couldn't find any other. Maybe someone else might have something if it's interesting. Thank you.
Here we see Jacob in being afraid. He divided his family into two bands. This is prophecy in the end of days that the family of Yahweh would be divided into two nations, Ephraim and Judah. And it's in the land where primarily Judah is. Judah is still scattered in the nations, but primarily in the land where the enemy is seeking to annihilate Judah in the land. Meanwhile, Yahweh has Ephraim as well as Judah still scattered in the nations. So the enemy cannot completely eradicate all of Israel. It's a prophecy that they would be in two bands when Esau is coming and seeking to kill Jacob. Anybody else have thoughts, questions, comments?
I have a question for you, Eddie, in regards to your teaching this morning. You talked about how that Zion would be born. Actually, Zion would come together as there would be two houses coming together within the land. Is that correct at that point? That they will come together and then Zion will be born out of, within the land, this Zion state?
Zion is born first.
Zion is born first.
And the gathering takes place following the physical birth of the nation.
All right, then who is Zion to birth or to bring forth the coming together?
Zion, which is the physical land.
Zion, the physical land.
It's not only the physical land.
Right.
But the physical land that's and the people who declare that land, that state, is called Zion. And it ultimately brings about the ingathering of the exiles, mm-hmm. which are the children of Zion, and it also bursts the acceptance of who the Messiah is and declaring who that Messiah is.
Are you saying it's going to be a Jewish group, or is it going to be a combined group of both Ephraimite and Judah?
That will return to the land?
No, that return to the land actually will be the birthing of this Zionistic state that will stand against
initially,
the divide into the land.
Initially, it will be Judah who will declare it and invite Ephraim to join with them if they're willing to stand for the land, stand for the covenant, and stand for the covenant promises.
Do you believe then that the ingathering will be after that the state begins, that there will be an opportunity then for, out of all the nations, the people to come, that that will be what is known as the Exodus, that they will then come to this particular Zionistic state that is standing in revolt to the nation of Israel?
Yes, the Exodus is leaving the nations of exile and ultimately the journey to return to the land.
So you're saying that the Exodus is talked about in Scripture. We see it several different places where Yahweh brings the people back into the land, is bringing them back to the land for this particular Zionistic state, which then births there's the birthing that takes place, right?
I believe as the gathering takes place, the revelation and acceptance to the Messiah will parallel it. In other words, right. When there is a when ultimately the exiles get to the land and there's the ultimate unification, there's the full knowledge of the Messiah. The understanding of who the Messiah is in declaring and appointing themselves one head, that process begins while his people are still in exile.
Okay, they're in exile and they're coming out of the land, but there are those that are in the land that are in this place of revolt against what is taking place with the dividing of the land. Now they're on their way, and yet you talked about in Isaiah 66 how there was a birthing within a day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it that particular revolt that you're referring to, or are you referring to then when people come into the land out of the various nations and form this new enlarged nation because of the two houses coming together in the land? What is it when you talk about Isaiah 66 and the birthing in a day? Is it referring to the revolt, or is it referring to the people then coming into the land out of the Exodus?
Initially, it's referring to the revolt.
The revolt.
And
okay.
The declaration of that state in one day. That's what, and the declaration of the state in the day is the nation being born in a day. But Zion, Messiah is birthed in Zion. And so Messiah, in the knowledge of who Messiah is, comes forth out of Zion.
Are you referring to Revelation chapter 12 when you're saying Messiah being birthed in Zion?
Well, Revelation chapter 12, and also, give me a moment for me to find the scripture. It says Zion, I believe it's in Psalms. This and that was born in her, something to that effect. Let's see if I can find it. It might take a moment, but Zion. Here it says, Psalm 87, verse 5. In of Zion it shall be said, this and that man was born in her. And the highest himself shall establish her. So the high establishes her, but this and that man was born in her.
Okay,
so it's from Zion bursts, Ephraim and Judah coming together and appointing themselves one head. That comes from Zion.
But the child is caught up into heaven in Revelation chapter 12.
Right. But this can, what he's referring to is Revelation chapter 12. It says, there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars, and she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth and pain to be delivered. That would be Isaiah chapter 66 and verse 7. And then it goes on to say that there appeared another wonder in heaven, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns. And it says, and his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. The meaning of that is that as soon as this state of Zion is declared, those nations, which is the whole world, who have endorsed the Palestinian state, will be required to oppose Zion in to violently do away with it. And that and the one behind doing this is called the Great Red Dragon. And she, that would be Zion, brought forth a man child, that is the Messiah. So from Zion being born is through and how the Messiah is revealed to his people and to the world, brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Because from Zion being born recognizing the Messiah, Messiah fighting for Zion, Messiah sets his seat down on the Mount of Olives, sets up his kingdom, and rules all nations. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. Now, one way to interpret this is not that somehow people's flying away into heaven to the throne, is the throne represents power and authority. And so being caught up to the throne means you've been given power and authority ultimately to rule and reign, because Zion redeemed is going to rule and reign in the earth. We see the same thing in Revelation chapter 14, where it says a lamb stood on Mount Zion with him 144,000. And it goes on to say, verse 3, and they sung as it were a new song before the throne. They're singing the new song before the throne. So literally you would think, well, how'd they get to the throne? Well, they had to get up there somehow. How'd they get up there? They got raptured. But the 144,000 are on Mount Zion. And Mount Zion is the place that is described as where we return to in Messiah by being redeemed in him, by the exiles of Israel coming together. And the new song is the song of redemption. So they're singing it before the throne. So does this literally mean that the 144,000 are up in heaven at the throne? I think it refers to, just the same in Revelation 12, it refers to the 144,000 are given authority in the earth. Remember it says in Revelation chapter 7 about the 144,000? They're given that authority because it says, verse 1, after these things I saw four angels standing on the four corners holding the four winds, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on the tree. And I saw another angel ascending, having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our Elohim in their foreheads. So his servants are first sealed, and the reason why they are sealed is they're given authority in the earth to rule and reign. Now, in Revelation 14:4, about the 144,000, it says, they were redeemed from among men. They are the first fruits unto Elohim in the earth. Yeah. So, for example, Revelation 14:4, it says, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. And almost everybody I've heard sort of takes that literally. Well, if you go back and look at the Tanakh, Israel was defiled with women. How were they defiled? They went after idolatry and strange gods. So when it means that they're not defiled with women, it means that they have not went after foreign gods, strange gods. I don't believe that is being literal, that the 144,000, for example, none of them has ever been married. I don't believe it's literal. It means that they have not participated in the idolatry and the paganism of this world. So in that regard, I would interpret that they've caught up to the throne, not being literal, because we know that it's during this time that the exiles are returning back to the land, so they're not up into heaven, so it must be allegorical that the throne represents authority and power. Back to you.
Well, just kind of let it go back to Mark for right now. I don't want to spend too much time with at this point, so Mark, why don't you just go ahead and keep on going here.
Any other questions and comments? Anyone in Pal Talk have a question or a comment they'd like to get in on that? If not, Eddie, it's time to read through the rest of the chapter from 13 to the end.
Okay, Genesis chapter 32 and verse 13. And we're going to go through the end of the chapter, you said? And he lodged there that same night and took of that which came to his hand a present for Esau his brother, 200 she-goats, 20 he-goats, 200 ewes, and 20 rams, 30 milch camels with their colts, 40 kine and 10 bulls, 20 donkeys, and 10 foals, and delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by themselves, and said unto his servants, Pass over before me, and put a space between drove and drove. And he commanded the foremost, saying, When Esau my brother meets you and asks, saying, Who are you, and whither you go, and who are these before you? Then shall you say, They be your servant Jacob's. It is a present sent unto my lord Esau, and behold, also he is behind us. And so commanded he the second and the third and all that followed the drove, saying, On this manner shall you speak unto Esau when you find him. And say, moreover, Behold, your servant Jacob is behind us, for he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterward I will see his face, peradventure he will accept of me. So went the present over before him, and himself lodged that night in the company. And he rose up that night and took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons and passed over the ford Jabbok. And took them, and sent them over the brook, and sent over that he had had. And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of his thigh. He said, Let me go, for the day breaks. And he said, I will not let you go, except you bless me. And he said, What's your name? And he said, Jacob. He said, Your name will no more be Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince you have power with Elohim with men, and have prevailed. And Jacob asked him and said, Tell me, I pray thee, your name. And he said, Wherefore is it that you do ask me your name? And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen Elohim face to face, and my life is preserved. And as he passed over Peniel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. Therefore the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh in the sinew that shrank. Mark?
Thank you, bro. Genesis 32, 13 to 23. Yaakov stayed overnight in Mahanaim, and he separated out a bunch of animals and sent his peace offerings to Esau. Notice that the numbers were all even: 200 he-goats, etc., or she-goats rather, etc. These are the total numbers that he sent, but he divided them into two groups, as well as dividing his family. All of the groups are spaced some distance apart so that, I think, Esau will think that there are more people and cattle with Jake than he has men to handle. Or, perhaps his larcenous nature may have thought that this was a lot of stuff to take possession of. So Jake gave instructions on how his servants were to speak to Esau. Jake knew the customs of the area and how to deal with these folks. He also knew the nature of Esau and how to soften him up. The servants went ahead with the bribes, presents, and Jake spent the night in the camp, not in his tent. This was not normally where he slept, or it would not have been mentioned the way that it was. After the camp was asleep, he gathered up his wives and kids and slipped across the brook to be that much further from Esau and less accessible. In all this, Jake was walking in his sight rather than the assurance that Yahweh would deliver on his promise. In verses 24 through 32, Jake was alone at the fords of the Jabbok, his wives and his kids across the brook, and his servants and belongings in the camp yonder. And there came a man to him whom he wrestled with all the rest of that night. His wrestling through the night represents those days of tribulation, when Yaakov's sons will have great trials of faith and endurance. When this comes on them, that's us, it will be well for them, that's us, to remember this passage. It is given for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come. Please note that the spiritual cannot overcome the flesh unless the flesh is either weakened or it submits to the spiritual. The Spirit of Elohim will not force His will on us. We must be willing to do as He commands in order to be used of Him. He can use our fleshly lust to His advantage, but when we submit to the Spirit of Elohim, He can use us. This second is much more preferable and better for us, if not immediately, then at least in eternity. Again, the Ruach cannot prevail over the flesh, for he speaks in a still small voice, while the flesh, jumps up and down, screaming and playing like a kazoo, to make sure that it has our attention. For Ruach to control us, we must make a conscious effort to submit to him and obey his lead. Yaakov wrestled with the man, until the man, rather, dislocated the hollow of Jake's thigh, that is, his hip, the strongest muscle and joint and the sturdiest bone in the human body. And, knowing Yah as I do, he chose the dominant hip to dislocate. But still, Jake wouldn't release the man until he had his blessing. And what a blessing it was. He gave him a new name. If you'll look in Yeshayahu 62, 1 and 2, why don't we look these, somebody, we got Bibles all over the place.
That's very good.
Somebody grab Yeshayahu 62, 1 and 2. Okay, somebody got Revelation. Okay, you got 62, 12, 17, Revelation 2 and 17, and Revelation 3 and 12. Okay. Take it, Yeshayahu. That would be Teresa, right? 62, 1 and 2.
Isaiah 62, 1 and 2. For Zion's sake I will not keep silent. For Jerusalem's sake I will not keep quiet, until her brightness goes forth like brightness, and her salvation like a torch that is burning. The nations will see your righteousness, and all kings your glory, and you will be called by a new name, which the mouth of Yahweh will designate.
Amen. Revelation 2:17.
Revelation 2:17. He who has an ear, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the assemblies. To him who overcomes, I shall give some of the hidden manna to eat, and I shall give him a white stone, and on the stone a renewed name, written which no one knows except him who receives it.
And 3:12.
He who overcomes, I shall make him a supporting post in the dwelling place of my Elohim, and he shall by no means go out. And I shall write on him the name of my Elohim and the name of the city of my Elohim, the renewed Yerushalayim, which comes down out of the heaven from my Elohim and my renewed name.
Okay. Interesting, isn't it? Those are the only passages that say new name in the King James, in the entire Bible. This one and those three that we just quoted. He's going to give overcomers new names. The only people that get new names are his overcomers. Okay? Those overcomers we spoke about just a minute ago, 144,000 in the Revelation, is who that's talking about. Jake's new name was Israel. That means he is Prince of Elohim. We will receive our new names, those of us who overcome, whoever we may be, and it may not be me, at the end of the tribulation. Even as Israel got his as the sun rose upon him, or the night ended and the day broke, the tribulation ends and the messianic kingdom begins. That's when we get our new names. That's when Israel got his new name, as the day broke, as the sun arose at the end of the night, as the kingdom begins at the end of the tribulation, that's when we receive our names. Okay, now we're open to questions and comments on all of chapter 32.
Well, I do believe that Jacob was double-minded. He cried out to Yahweh on behalf of his promise, but he acted like a completely natural man, offering all of his possessions.
And that's exactly where Israel is now,
right?
The nation of Israel. And when Zion comes to birth, they will be after Yahweh's heart, and they will be as the Jacob will see in chapter 33.
But I want you to see, as a result of the natural effort to do things according to natural eyes, it resulted in him being up all night and being left alone, Genesis 32:24, and wrestling with the man until the breaking of the day. You notice victory did not come through his efforts to appease Esau. His victory overcame by receiving the blessing from the one who he's wrestling with, who I believe is the Messiah. And it's only by receiving the blessing of the Messiah was he able to be victorious in Esau, not in his own efforts. So I believe that this is a prophecy of how the family of Jacob will respond, and ultimately how we will, as a corporate people in Messiah, will respond to the tribulation. We'll cry out in prayer for Messiah to save us, and then we're going to do everything in the natural to put things in our favor, thinking that if we do it and put things in our favor, then that's how our deliverance was come, with a prayer. But that only results in being left alone. Because ultimately, we are to prepare, but prepare according to trusting in Him. How do you prepare but in trusting in Him? You prepare believing His word. For example, if you leave your homes and go into the wilderness taking provisions because you believe His word, because you believe that He'll take care of you ultimately when you go, then that is preparing while trusting. But if you decide that, well, if I do this in the natural because it makes logical sense and that's how I'm going to be delivered, then you are acting in with your natural eyes according to natural logic, by sight rather than faith. So this is the challenge that we will have. This is the challenge that Jacob had. And so this is a prophetic then of Jacob's end time struggle with Esau, which results in Jacob's trouble, Jeremiah 30 verse 7. And nobody comes to Jacob's side, who ultimately is Zion in the end of days. And so Zion is left alone. And Zion is going to wrestle with a man until the breaking of the day. The man is the Messiah. They're going to be wrestling with who is the Messiah. They'll be doing it until the tribulation is over, until the breaking of the day. And those who receive the blessing are those who overcome, who have been touched by the Messiah, and He's changed their walk. Because when Jacob had what happened on his thigh, he walked differently. So walk. And then he named the name the place Peniel. Peniel means the face of Elohim. And it's when Zion is born that Messiah will no longer hide His face but reveal His face. And so that day, Zion being redeemed, is a day of face to face. Face to face is also a term for Yom Kippur. Anybody else have any thoughts, questions, comments?
I got a comment. Esau seems to kind of carry on an evil mantle, say from Cain, Nimrod, Esau. And it seems to be a type that maybe even goes on, well, does go on today. Jacob seems to have been really intimidated by Esau, and that seems to be a type. Even though Jacob was actually obviously a very tough guy. I mean, here he's wrestling this guy and he's not letting go even though his hip's broken. That's a tough guy. Dislocated. That's a lot of pain.
Bad enough.
Yeah. That's painful, right? So he's a tough guy, but he's still intimidated by this Esau. Now the story goes that when Jacob died, they took him to bury him in the cave that his mother and father were buried in. And Esau and his men showed up, and there was a dispute. and one of Joseph's grandchildren, who was deaf and dumb, stepped forward and cut off Esau's head. Do you think that has any insight or is telling us anything? Is that something like maybe it's just this intimidation that's intimidated so much it's going to take somebody who's not aware of some of this stuff to really step forward and do something?
I'm thinking about what the analogy of Jacob coming up against Esau and his 400 men is very similar to Israel today up against the 100-some-change million Edomites that are coming after him, Esau and Jacob. It's still the same fight. So, yeah, it equates very well. Israel that is today is just like Jacob was then. And they are not walking after Yahweh's heart. They're walking after their sight. There's no faith involved in the secular nation of Israel. We were talking about Zion a minute ago, and how Zion is going to be that's the believing remnant out of Judah is going to start that thing. They're going to ask Ephraim, those who will walk with them and with the covenant. And so I really believe that it's that the wrestling with Messiah for that 3.5 years or however long it's going to be will be because they're going to have a witness of Ephraimites who will really be after Yahweh's heart and really after Torah. And that's what's going to make them question, is this really the Messiah? Okay? I don't know if I answered your question, but I hit on two things that came up in the last couple of minutes that I thought were important.
I think the noted fact of the change that took place after he was wrestled was a humbling experience, and I think it was a needful thing for him because I think that there was pride showed there. Now the other person that I can tell you is very significant in the Brit Hadashah was Paul. You see, he had the thorn in the flesh that wouldn't leave. We don't exactly know what it is, but it was a humbling experience for him that he would not be puffed up. And that's a picture of that. So it's a double witness is what it is. That we need to do that. We need to humble ourselves before him. Yeah.
I just wonder if we're going to be wrestled up ahead of time, or if we're going to be just like him and have to wrestle at the last minute for what we're going through.
The scripture, 2 Corinthians 12:9, comes to mind. And he said to me, "My favor is sufficient for you, for my power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, then, I shall rather boast in my weaknesses so that the power of Messiah rests on me."
As Jacob was returning to Israel, or to Canaan at that time, I'm sure he had on his mind his relationship with Esau. Now, he realized that he had rightfully gotten the birthright, but with regards to the blessing was another matter. It was through his agreement with his mother that he decided to go ahead and go on with this deception. And so there was a deception that perpetrated against Isaac and against Esau, because it was Isaac's intention to place the blessing upon Esau. And as a result of that, Esau had decided that he was going to kill his brother Jacob. He had comforted himself in that, and that's part of the reason why Rebekah had spoken to Jacob and told him that it would be best if he went to stay with her brother. And so, even though he had been told by Yahweh to return to the land, he still knew that there was still this contention that existed between he and his brother, and that he had some responsibility in what had taken place. Now, if he would have done it right, if he had not just followed the instruction of his mother, but had gone to his father and talked to his father about the very fact that he had the birthright, and explained to him that, you know, according to what would be tradition, that he should receive the greater part of the blessing as well, because he had the right of the firstborn. But he didn't go to that approach. And so as a result of that, he was left with this situation that had to be dealt with. And so there was the opportunity to help for him to humble himself and to even present some type of a offering or a present of reconciliation to Esau. And so I believe that there was some need to present a present of reconciliation, opportunity to be reconciled to his brother, and not just to come with the intention of fighting Esau. Because when he had heard that there were 400 men that were coming with Esau, I'm sure that he said, well, I guess Esau has definitely intended to use this particular method to deal with me, rather than trying to, at this point in time, to bring about reconciliation. So he knew it wasn't going to be an easy issue. It was going to be tough. And he definitely was alarmed. And so, rightly so, he reminded Yahweh in his prayers of the promises that were given to him and how he had been instructed to come back and how he was told that he would be made a great company as the sand of the sea would fill the land, and all the promises that were made to the patriarchs were made onto him. And so, in coming the way that he did, I believe that he was approaching in the correct way, even though he was setting up what would be, at least at that time, ways in which he would appease Esau's anger. When he did wrestle with this man, I believe he was Yeshua or definitely Yahweh, that the word wrestle there has with it the meaning of ered or dust. And so there was actually a grappling, a rolling. It has a term of rolling in the dust. So he was actually rolling in the dust with this man in the desert there, just gripping him and struggling. And it's like what we will have to do in regards to intercession. Intercession is not always easy, and there is something that we really need to consider with these various issues that are coming before us, even as we were reminded in our 5-minute news update that there are various things that are happening in this world that would precipitate this great tribulation. Even now, there's someone next to me whose husband has been slated to be deported back to Nigeria. I shared with you all last week how Deborah's husband, Isaac, was going to be facing a hearing. Well, we went to the hearing and we found out from the judge that their intention, and of course their ruling, his ruling at this point, is to now send Isaac to Nigeria with the sentence of being an aggravated felon. And so there is going to be a need for wrestling and grappling, intercession with Yahweh on his behalf, and he himself and his family will have to do the same, because there's the spiritual and there is the natural. Now there is an appellate process or a way to appeal this particular ruling, and he has 30 days in which to appeal, but that may not change anything, because I believe it's their intention to send him back. But it doesn't mean that it can't be changed if Yahweh decides differently. Whatever can be done can only be done in the spirit if it's to be done effectively for righteousness' sake. If it's done in the flesh, it will accomplish nothing. But if it's done in the Spirit, it will bring glory to Yahweh Elohim. And this is what is my desire, is that Yahweh will receive glory through what is taking place in this family situation. And so I would solicit your grapplings with this man we know as Yeshua on behalf of Isaac. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I just want to add one more thing. During the hearing, nothing was mentioned about Isaac's religion until the prosecutor got up there. He wasn't satisfied that Isaac was a Christian. He demanded to know what sect. Isaac told him he's Messianic Christian. The prosecutor apparently knew exactly what that was, because he asked him, "Do you celebrate Sabbath and do you follow Torah?" And Isaac said, "Every Saturday."
And actually what the prosecutor was doing, I was there, I witnessed it, was trying to belittle messianic Christian faith as not being legitimate or being out of accepted mainstream as far as the government goes. And this is the spirit that has taken over this country and ultimately will cause Jacob to return to his land. You know what? I just thought of something. as we all know, Nigeria is a challenging place for someone like Isaac to return to. There is a scripture, and I got to find it, whether it's in Jeremiah 50 or 51. Let me look it up here, and we'll get it. And I just thought of this right now. It says in Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 16, "For fear of the oppressing sword, they shall turn every one to his people, and they shall flee every one to his own land. For flee of the oppressing sword in Babylon, every one will flee to their own land." It appears as though Isaac is going back to his native land, but he's just going there a little bit earlier than when Babylon is attacked. But the scripture says that everyone flee to his own land. Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 16.
It doesn't say that that person would be in bondage and subjected to a crime that he didn't commit in that land. It alludes to that the people will run on their own accord to their land, and Isaac has been denied voluntary departure as a free man. He will be chained and escorted and turned over to the authorities as a criminal.
It's all true. And Yeshua was chained, in essence, and Paul and Silas and John, as a criminal. Okay, anybody else have further thoughts, questions, comments about... We are in Genesis chapter 32 through the end of the chapter. Anyone, any thoughts, questions, comments on Genesis 32 through the end of the chapter, either here or in Paltalk land? Let's go to Genesis chapter 33, verses 1 through 17, which finishes the portion. "Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. Look, and he divided the children into Leah and to Rachel and unto the two handmaids, and he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. And he passed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, Who are those with you? And he said, The children which Elohim has graciously given your servant. Then the handmaidens came near, they and their children, and they bowed themselves. And Leah also with their children came near and bowed themselves. And after came Joseph near and Rachel, and they bowed themselves. And he said, What meanest thou by all the drove which I met? And he said, These are to find grace in your sight of my Lord. Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep that you have unto yourself. And Jacob said, Nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in your sight, then receive my present at your hand. For therefore I have seen your face as though I have seen the face of Elohim, and you was pleased with me. Take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to you, because Elohim has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. And he urged him, and he took it. And he said, Let us take our journey, and let us go, and I will go before you. And he said, My Lord knows that the children are tender, and the flocks and the herds with young are with me, and if men should overdrive them one day, all the flock will die. Let my Lord, I pray thee, pass over before his servant, and I will lead on softly according as the cattle that goes before me, and the children be able to endure until I come unto my lord unto Seir. And Esau said, let me now leave with you some of the folk that are with me. And he said, what needs it? Let me find grace in the sight of my lord. So Esau returned that day on his way unto Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Sukkot, and built him a house, and made booths for his cattle. Therefore, the name of the place is called Sukkot. Mark?
Okay. 31 through the end of the chapter. Or through 17, rather, because we're going to do the whole thing here. Start at the beginning. Where are you? There you are. As Yaakov comes out of the brook at Penuel, he lifts his eyes to see Esau riding up with those 400 close friends we spoke about earlier. I want us to notice how different Jake is this morning. Yesterday, he was putting as much space and bodies between him and Esau as he could. Today, he still divides the family into three camps, but now he goes forward first to protect his wives and children. He doesn't hide among them as he had in the camp the night before, but goes right to the source of the trouble, like the real man he had just become. He humbles himself before his older brother, who climbs down to embrace Jake as they probably had not done since the womb. The root beneath the word kissed is neshach. Nun, shin, and kuf are the letters. Neshach in Paleo-Hebrew means to touch in love with the lips, or in battle with weapons. Boy, those are two different, completely different meanings, aren't they? To touch is the main idea. But every time we see the English word kiss in the Torah, it's translated from neshach. Where does the idea of Torah, of touching with a weapon, come from then? Because they all mean kiss. Okay, I think mainly from this passage. Mainly because the rabbis tell us that the jots of Moshe above the word Vanishakehu, Vav, Nun, Shin, Kuf, He, Vav, six letters, each with a dot above it in the Masoretic text, that those dots represent the six upper teeth of Esau as he attempted to bite Jake on the neck to rip out his jugular. It corresponds to all the teeth between the canine, from the canine to the canine on top. They're the biting, tearing teeth. Okay. Also, the word neshek, spelled the same, means to equip with weapons. Do you think maybe that Judas's kiss might have been like Esau's? After Esau met Jake's families in plural, he asks what all the animals meant. What follows after that is a typical Middle Eastern bargain. I used to love to go to the souk when I was in Bahrain, when I was in the Navy. You get to find out just how those guys love the art of haggling. The customer asks how much for the merchandise. The merchant asks how much the customer would like to pay. The customer lowballs the guy, who begs for mercy since he has wives and children to feed. The customer signals how serious he is about the buy if he acquiesces and raises his offer, but only because he would not want the merchant's family to die of starvation. And so on and so on. And it is so much fun. You cannot believe how much fun it is. Or it can be absolutely maddening. Okay, you could be made absolutely crazy by such a thing. Depends on the customer's attitude. Jake answered with, they're yours. Send so that you'll be friendly to me. Esau doesn't want to seem greedy, but acknowledges that Jake has some nice stuff and does not want to cut off this sweet connection for meat and rich sons-in-law. So he says, I'm already a rich man, brother. Keep it for yourself. In this, Esau is also thinking, if I take the stuff, how can I justify ripping out his heart? I'll be shunned by my pagan buddies. But Jake says, no, bro, if you like me, the best modern-day translation, by the way, of if I have found grace in your sight, means if you like me. Okay, if you like me, keep the stuff. I've already been repaid enough just by seeing your sweet face, my beloved brother. You're almost as handsome as Yahweh, because remember, he had just seen Yahweh. Despite what it says in verse 11, I don't think it took a lot of urging for Esau to make off with the booty. He did, however, try to get Jake to go stay out in front of him. I think he was keeping him in sight so he wouldn't steal the gift back, but Jake said that he would just slow Esau down too much, what with the wives and kids and animals and all. Jake said, nah, you go on ahead and we'll see you at Seir. When Esau went ahead towards Seir, Jake turned aside to Sukkot. Interesting, isn't it, that he goes to Sukkot? How much will you bet that all of this coincided with the Feast of Sukkot? I've got 50 in my pocket that says it does. 50 cents. 50 cents. I got 50 cents. When will day break after the tribulation? When will Yeshua walk in the gates of Jerusalem? First day of Sukkot. You betcha. That's what it's talking about. So I'm going to open this up to questions.
We are looking at a prophetic picture of a return to the land. And returning to the land in Genesis chapter 33, we see that Leah and her children in Genesis 33:2 went before Rachel and Joseph. That's a prophecy that Judah will return to the land first, and at the end, Joseph will return to the land. And then we see in that return, Jacob journeyed to Sukkot. He journeyed to Sukkot. So it's a prophecy that the return to the land is associated with going to Sukkot. Anybody in the congregation or in Paltalk land have any further thoughts, questions, comments? Go ahead.
I've been wanting to ask this question. In years, you know how the Lord says a day is as a thousand years? So I don't think you could put it together for this one, but if the day starts, well, the day starts at sunset, so it begins in darkness, and then you're talking about the break of day is when the Lord will come. How many years is that darkness, or what portion of the day is the daybreak?
Well, it's not according to Greek mathematics, like half and half, thankfully. We know from Scripture that the day of Yahweh, or the Messianic era, that starts with tribulation, that the tribulation ends when Messiah sets his feet down in the Mount of Olives, and we know from Scripture that there's only a 3.5-year great tribulation. When he sets his feet down the Mount of Olives, that's the breaking of the day. That's the night ending. And then from there on out, we have him ruling and reigning in the earth, which is a time of peace on the earth. They beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. So, for those who say there's a 10-year tribulation, we have 10 years of tribulation, 990 years of light. Those who say seven years, tribulation, 993 years of light. Those who just want to measure it by the 3.5-year great tribulation, we have really darkness in 3.5 years and the rest. Thankfully, it's not 500 years of darkness and 500 years of light, or else we would all be in trouble. Some people would be born and they'd only be living through great tribulation. And I'm not quite sure if the human race could stand that. Thankfully, it's only 3.5 years.
The 3.5-year length for the Great Tribulation is actually the conventional wisdom, though, Eddie. I've been coming to consider that it's not anywhere near that long, the Great Tribulation. Tribulation probably will be 7 years total, as in the last week of years from Daniel chapter 9, although that could be wrong, too. I'm thinking that the Great Tribulation, the one that's talked about as the wrath of Yahweh, is actually only a short period, 10 days to 2 weeks. And it happens quickly, and that's why it's so intense. And I believe personally that happens after the righteous the righteous remnant is removed. But yeah, that fits the pattern of the feasts, that the Great Tribulation begins with the beginning of the Days of Awe, and the Days of Awe correspond to the Great Tribulation. Okay. Yeah, 10 literal days. Yeah. Now that I could be wrong about that, but I really think that's a better way of looking at this than, because there isn't any 3.5 year period between.
I think those 10 days that you're talking to has a specific name to describe the seriousness of them within the 3.5 year period.
I was just going to say that perhaps that's making reference to where the Lord said that for the elect's sake he would cut the time short.
Yeah, I agree. That's exactly what it's talking about. I really believe that it's that there will be a rapture right before the end of the tribulation, but we get to live through most of it. And it's only the very days that are specifically mentioned as the wrath of God and those vials being poured out that are the Great Tribulation. But again, I could be wrong.
I wanted to comment on verse 10 when Jacob does meet Esau. It is very favorable. I see what Mark's saying about it just seems really condescending upon their relationship, and the way Jacob treats Esau is very good in the sense that he's grateful that he has found favor in his eyes, just as he has found favor in Elohim's eyes, and he has been blessed. And I mean, could you imagine seeing your brother's face after seeing Elohim's face in it, associating them with each other? That's really powerful.
Well, I personally don't believe he was literal. I believe he was trying to speak nice words so he can get through the moment. I don't think he literally meant it. He was trying to speak nice words to get through the moment because he was petrified. Go ahead.
Okay. I guess Well, then back to with... I wanted to see...
Well, let's put it this way. I don't think Esau would be somebody that you would want to marry.
No, I don't think that either.
I don't think the parents
would love it. No, that's not really...
You know, if he looked like the angel...
No, that's not what I mean. I'm just mean that he... The relationship was sweet at that time, it seemed to me, the fact that
I would disagree because he came with 400 men.
Right, his intention was evil. It was. That's very clear. Yeah. But he found favor yet.
There's a balance to be seen here. Yes, Esau, Jacob was terrified of Esau. But I also believe he really did love his brother. And he hasn't seen him in 20 years, and so the natural tendency for that would be to really be happy to see him as well.
Scared to death,
but happy at the same time.
Finish your thought.
Well, and just that Jacob is a type of Yeshua, and Dad was commenting to me last night that, just as Yeshua rose before daybreak, that's when Yaakov was given the strength to their Peniel, and so I wanted to try and make some association with Jacob and Yeshua, and I still would like some input on that, but just in how that relates to him meeting Esau too, I didn't really know, but
Well, Esau, I believe, is kind of like Saul, King Saul, and there were times when he wanted to kill David, not because of who David was as a person, because I think he actually liked David as a person, but he didn't like what he represented. But for Saul, after David had spared his life in the cave and also when he was on the hill, he repented of what he did. I mean, of what Saul was intention of killing David. And so I think it's kind of the same situation in that Esau has repented of this desire to kill Jacob because he sees that there is truly contrition. There's truly a desire to be forgiven for what he did against him. And like I said, he did perform a deception against, and it had not been reconciled. He had never gone to, at least to my knowledge, he'd never gone to Esau, it's never recorded, before the event of leaving for Padan Aram, and actually having asked for forgiveness for actually deceived his father to get the blessing. Again, it has nothing to do with the birthright. That was legitimate, above board, all the way. But the deception was not. And so again, I believe that Esau really was wanting to forgive him, and I think in his heart he was. But once he got back, it's like those old demons again. Like Saul was he was troubled by a lot of demons. And I think that Esau was kind of in that same category. And he said he was like a Nimrod, like what David had said, that he represented in a lot of respects the same kind of an attitude, and where he had this thing working on his mind. And I think that there were things that he said that were passed on to his children that continued to keep that fire of revenge going, that desire to want to get back, that never was quenched, because he just talked about it. And in the same way that Saul talked about it with his own children, he said to Jonathan, "What are you doing? I mean, how could you befriend this Bethlehemite? Because he's going to take away he's going to take away the kingship from you." And yet, of course, Jonathan's love for David would never be broken. But that's getting away from the subject here. But still, I believe that the intentions that Esau had, that he carried within him, were calmed for the moment. They were they subsided for a period of time, be it until he was halfway back with his men and began to start getting... Well, of course, he's had those... I can imagine, too, he probably looked at those animals...
Probably one step back.
He had those animals to look at, too. He looked at those 30 camels, and he's going, you know... And every time he saw those camels and various calves and sheep and whatnot give birth and realize that they had come from Jacob, that probably helped out a little bit. But, you know, there was still always that same thing that he'd already talked about, and it probably was something that just never quite got over. But again, that's something that it's not written into the narrative, and so we really don't know.
Yeah, we do. We keep reading our Bible. We see how Esau, Edom, always at an opportunity, entered into conflict with Jacob from generation to generation to prove your point.
Yeah, I agree. We'll see that. In fact, I throw those references here, and you're right, Eddie, that there is definitely a clear indication that it is not forgotten, and it is carried from generation to generation to generation. And in fact, it seems like it's gotten worse, because there's so much more desire to just to kill them. And it's gone back and forth on both behalf of Israel as well as on Jacob. As you read about what happened by the kingship of David under the commandership of Joab, when Joab went down and slaughtered Edomites until there weren't very many of them left. So anyway,
I remember too, when they were entering into the land, Yahweh told them not to, he said to leave the Edomites alone. He said, you know, let them be. He said they were to be in just neutral ground, you know, not to attack them or take them out. So, but Eddie, if you have anything to share with what I was asking about Jacob being in relation to Yeshua.
I just the thing about Sukkot just has really stayed with me, that when we finally learn not to appease the enemy or do things the world's ways, then we will go to Sukkot and we won't follow. We won't go to Seir.
Go ahead.
Well, that was an excellent observation. Yeah, he had just wrestled with Yahweh all night, and as he departs from his brother, he says, "No, you go on to Seir, and I'll meet you there." And then Esau takes off, and he gets far enough ahead, and Jacob says, "Okay, I'm going to Sukkot. I'm tired of this wrestling back and forth. I'm done. I'm going to be with Yah." and that was the idea, I think.
Another thing too is we're not to tell our brother or those that we think would be close to us where we're going. You know, I mean, if we're going to be going into the wilderness, we don't want to be betrayed and give away where we're fleeing to.
What's the scripture for that? That we're not supposed to tell where we're going.
It's just wisdom that if you don't tell your adversaries where you're going to be if they have a desire to hurt you.
Right. Now, most people wouldn't think of their mother or their sister or their brother or whatever being their adversary. But if you're a believer in Yahweh and you're following Torah, you got to be careful about even telling believers who are not following Torah about what your plans are, because they will, to save their own lives, tell the authorities where you're going.
I believe there are several scriptures about that. One of them, of course, is to be wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove. But there's some other ones that I've seen, but I just don't remember where they are, and I thought maybe you had that you aren't supposed to tell. I know never cast your pearls before a swine, but
in regards to the term Sukkot, I looked it up, and it means, of course, tabernacle, tent, booth. It means to hedge in for protection, a covering, or defense. It also has interesting indication as well that it has the meaning of harpoon or barbed thorn, which I believe indicates that it was like a needle that was used in probably the stitching up of the material to make the tent. And it's interesting in that you read about Gideon when he was, I know this is kind of getting away from the point, but
Getting away from the main point.
I didn't realize I made it funny. Where's Bill? Hey, Bill. So I know Eddie got it, but Bill should have got it too. But he's not here. So Eddie got it. Anyway, Gideon.
Away
from
what
I was
saying.
Thought about
that all weekend and practiced it for this moment.
In that when Gideon disciplined the men of Succoth because they would not help him, when he was chasing after some of the Midianite leaders, that when he came back to discipline them, he took the leaders and he took thorns and he whipped them with these thorns. It was like he was whipping them from the men of Sukkot, he was whipping them with Sukkot. Isn't that kind of interesting that he was using Sukkot on the people of Sukkot? Mm-hmm. I just thought that was something that was interesting that was in there. So anyway, that's it.
Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments?
Yeah, the reason that I spilled that was because I was picking up my mic. It's interesting that the place called Sukkot in Israel wasn't called that until Jacob went there and built booths for his cattle. That's what it says right there in 31:17.
Yeah. Because he did that, so the name of the place was called.
Correct.
Sukkot.
Thank you.
Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments? Anyone else with thoughts, questions, comments regarding Genesis 32 and Genesis 33? Well, let's go on to our Brit, not our Brit Hadashah, our Haftorah portion. Our Haftorah portion comes from the book of Obadiah, which happens to be one chapter, and we are to read one verse. But the book of Obadiah is a judgment against Esau in the day of Yahweh for, I'm having an attitude of and performing violence against Jacob. Obadiah 1:1. The vision of Obadiah, thus says Yahweh Elohim concerning Edom. We have heard a rumor from Yahweh, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us go up against her in battle. And goes on to say in verse 10, for your violence against your brother Jacob, shame will cover you. You'll be cut off forever. And it says in verse 15, the day of Yahweh is upon the heathen. And verse 21, saviors will come on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom will be Yahweh's. Notice what is associated with the tribulation and Messiah's coming is victory over Esau in the conflict. Mark.
Okay. Obadiah 1:1. I want you to know something, folks. I actually put together more words than are in that verse. And that was really difficult. Not many, but anyway, in verse 1:1, it says, Adonai Yahweh says that we heard from Yahweh. Okay? This points out the plurality of the Godhead. Okay? It says, Adonai Yahweh, a particular manifestation of Yahweh, if you want to use it that way, says that we have heard from Yahweh. So there are at least two that heard from Yahweh. That's one. So two plus one equals how many? One. All are Yahweh. Looks like the rumor, by the way, in that verse, rumor from Yahweh, that's what we heard. Looks like the rumor is that Edom will rise up against Israel. Sounds like Beit Yaakov's tribulation to me. And I don't mean just this congregation, but I mean the entire house of Jacob. Okay? Sounds like their tribulation to me. And so that's how that particular verse ties in with the rest of the scriptures, even to Tehillim 27, which we're about to read.
Anybody else in the congregation or in Pell Talk with thoughts, questions, comments about Obadiah chapter 1, verse 1, or even the entire book of Obadiah? Go ahead.
I was going to say verse 10. I mean, it's all full of the whole idea of what Esau has done. I don't know why they left it off at just verse 1. And you can. If you start it, you got to keep going all the way through. It's only one chapter, so to speak, all verses.
Yeah, but by this time it was 10:15 last night.
Okay. That's all right. But in verse 10 it says, because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame, and you will be cut off forever. You know, we don't read of that much violence being done by Esau. In fact, he attempted to. I mean, he was preparing to in himself, but it was what was done in his progeny, in his generations that would follow, that would actually do the violence to the sons of Jacob. What is being done even now? Yes. Yes, even now.
That word that says violence there in verse 10 is what word in Hebrew?
Hamas. No, it's
Hamas. Which is the way that it's pronounced. It's pronounced Hamas. Okay?
I like verse 9, 8 and 9. Even 7. All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread have laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. Shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of the mount of Esau? And thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. Well, one of the things that Eddie was bringing up during the morning message was that if the Lord chooses to do the Exodus the way he did to Egypt, the firstborn will be slaughtered by a sudden plague.
You brought out a very important verse, and that's in Obadiah chapter 1. Hey, that's a delay. That's a delay tactic. Obadiah chapter 1 verse 7. All the men of your confederacy have brought you even to your border. The men that were at peace with you have deceived you. You brought that verse out. That's a very important verse. And thank you for bringing it out, because it tells us that Esau will be making peace with Jacob. in the day of Yahweh, that will be a piece of deceit. Very good.
That's exactly what we were talking about a minute ago. The people who you think are your friends are the ones who are going to turn you over to your enemy. Okay, so you got to be real careful about who you're talking to and what you're telling them. It's a need-to-know basis, folks. Okay? Think about this as secret, top-secret, national security information.
Wait. Are you trying
okay?
to say...
I'm.
Wait a second. Are you trying to say, in essence, we're a secret society?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We're a cult, didn't you know? No, the... Seriously. This kind of information that you're wherever it is, whatever it is that you're going to do when the time comes, you can't tell anyone other than your most trusted confidants and people who will be going with you. Okay. In other words, in this congregation, we can tell just each other.
And out of those most trusted confidants, according to Scripture, someone in that group is going to betray you and think they're doing a service unto Yahweh. But so be it, because ultimately,
you
think it's me? No, I'm not telling you people anything. You know, and that's one of the things, you know, we've talked about it before, you know, we've talked about it through the yeshivas, is everybody says, well, what to do? How do you get ready? And Eddie's going to be, you know, dealing with some of that in the coming weeks through the help of some DVDs from a man named Mike Clayton, who, those who are in Sukkot in Oklahoma know Mike Clayton. If you're familiar with his website, you'll know Mike Clayton. I watched 16 hours of his DVDs this week. But ultimately, even I was talking to some of the people in this group sitting around these tables earlier today and said, you know, I don't know how much food, water, or gear you have, nor should I know. I just know we're all preparing to whatever Yahweh leads us to. Because each and every one of us, even at in these tables, these few families in Beit Yaakov, we're preparing according to the word of Yahweh. And God may have me prepare more or less according to my family, my neighborhood, the situations I will have to face. And if we start saying, well, I've got this much food and this much water and this much that and such, and then I'm going to do this, all we're doing is getting back into the worldly ways of competing with one another. We are now going to start competing with one another, which we should not be doing because we're family. And we're going to start saying, well, he has this much of gear and this much food, and I need this much, and we've now taken our eyes off the Father in doing what He told us to do, and we stopped trusting His Word and started trusting one another's more. And that's wickedness.
The way that confidential information is disseminated, we've got to do it like in the military.
It's like
okay?
The way you do it is to
broadcast
it over POW Talk, right?
First of all, it has to be that the person has the clearance. Now, the only people that have the clearance are fellow believers. Okay? And then, if they have the clearance, do they have the need to know? If they don't have the need to know, you got to keep your mouth shut. Okay? That's how you keep secrets. My wife got really ticked at me one time when I was in the Navy. I was in charge of the communication secure equipment on my helicopter. I had a whole bunch of things. Well, I had a combination in my head for the safe where we kept all the stuff. Well, she never come to the squadron. She wasn't going to have to, you know, I don't have to worry about her, you know, breaking into the safe or anything. But she says, well, what's the combination? And I said, well, I can't tell you. It's secret. And you don't, it's secret. You have neither the clearance nor the need to know. So I'm not going to tell you. She got ticked at me. I mean, really ticked at me because I wouldn't provide this information. And it was just a matter of four numbers. I mean, they're going to be changed tomorrow anyway, but that's not the point. The point is I was under orders not to give this information to anybody. And she, listen, this is the woman who, when we were brand new married, got a call from her mother who said, don't tell anybody, Debbie, but we're going to buy you a washing machine. Right? She says, okay, Mom, I won't tell anybody. Hangs up the phone without even taking a breath, says, Mark, Mom's buying us a washing machine. This tells me, do not tell this woman anything you don't want other people to know. Okay, she's watching from the kitchen, and the steam is starting to come out of her ears, and I'm probably not going to live with her for another week. But anyway, that's the point. Does the person have the right to know the information, and does the person have the need to know the information? If either one of those is not true, you cannot give the information, and that's just how it is. That is just how it is. He's got to have both prerequisites. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, we talked. We were talking earlier about how there was a woman that was in Revelation chapter 12 that was going to give birth to a child, and how that woman is being pursued by this dragon, and how then this dragon is actually trying to take the child, but before the dragon has opportunity, the child is taken up. And so then the woman, under duress, is then fleeing into the wilderness. And she goes there for 3.5 years. And I believe that there are clear indications that this woman that's in Zion, in the land of Israel, will flee into the region which would be the Negev, or even into Jordan, or even possibly into the areas of Edom. And so when we read the verses 12 on down, it's referring to what will happen in days yet to come. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune, and do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you. Do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster, and do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster. And do not stand at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives. And do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. For the day of the Lord draws near upon all nations. And I believe that's what we're going to see, is that this woman will then flee into the wilderness, where she'll be protected for 3.5 years. And at that time, she's going to be, you know, coming in contact with a few Edomites and other people of the region. And so they have the opportunity to be very watchful over their own lives, because I know that when Yeshua does come, he says, who is this that, Isaiah chapter 63, who is this that comes from Bozrah with his garments stained? And he's talking about being in the winepress of his wrath. And so it begins there in the regions of Edom, in the very city of Bozrah.
Anybody else? Thoughts?
I'm just thinking that that's probably where Yeshua goes first to wipe out the enemies. Goes first to Edom. Takes out the bad guys there. There is a blessing for Edom, though, is there not?
Oh, there's a blessing for everything.
There's even a blessing for the Tsar.
That's right. May God bless and keep Edom far away from us. That's it.
But, you know, one of the things in the scriptures that Ron was reading there a few moments ago about not rejoicing over them is, we're commanded just that. When our enemy, even when the enemy who hates us and tries to kill us falls, or shall we say in the common vernacular, guess what they got coming? Mm-hmm. We are not to rejoice over them. We are not to celebrate that. We are to weep and to wail, because we are to say, if only they had repented. That's the heart of the Father. Mm-hmm. We are to have the heart of Yahweh on this.
Okay. What, that there's a blessing for everything?
Well, the verses, though, that are referred to there are talking about, they're talking about actually Edom looking at his brother Judah. So it's Edom who's being warned by Yahweh not to rejoice or boast over the sons of Judah, or to do any of them harm. And so it's not us who are part of the camp of Israel, but it's referring to those who are part of the camp of Edom.
Here are some references for what Teresa was just saying a second ago. Proverbs 24:17, rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and let not thine heart be glad when he stumbleth. Amen. Isaiah 14:29, rejoice not thou whole Palestina, that's you Philistines, or Palestina, that's a King James meaning for Edom, as a matter of fact, because the rod of him that smote thee is broken. For out of the serpent's root shall come forth a cockatrice, and his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent. Oh my goodness. Rejoice not, O Israel, for joy as other people, for thou hast gone whoring from thy God, thou hast loved... Okay, rejoice not against me, O mine enemy. I'm sorry. Well, it looks like of those, Proverbs 24:17 is the best. Yeah, I could cross-reference. I could do that. Let's see. I think that'll do it. No, that's not going to work. Anyway, Proverbs 24:17. Do your cross-references from there. That's the best place to start.
Okay. Any other thoughts, questions, comments? How about if we go to Psalm 27? Are you ready for it? And before we go there, Teresa already can tell us what it's about. She hasn't even read it because she spent 16 hours this week watching DVDs on survival.
Well, I was previewing them for you, don't forget.
Oh, it's
Exile and Redemption.
Okay, very good. Okay. Mark, what's these notes I see that you have here? What's this psalm about, exile and redemption? Where'd you get that thought of?
What is this psalm about? We got the answer already, exile and redemption.
Wait, let's read it first. Yahweh is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Yahweh is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked, even my enemies and my foes, came upon me to eat up my flesh, they stumbled and fell. Though a host should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this will I be confident. One thing have I desired of Yahweh, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of Yahweh all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of Yahweh and to inquire in his temple. For in the time of trouble he will hide me in his pavilion. In the secret of his tabernacle he will hide me. He will set me upon a rock. And now shall my head be lifted up above my enemies round about. Therefore will I offer in his tabernacle sacrifices of joy. I will sing praises unto Yahweh. Hear, O Yahweh, when I cry with my voice, have mercy also upon me and answer me. When you said, seek ye my face, my heart said, your face, Yahweh, will I seek. Hide not your face far from me, put not your servant away in anger. You have been my help, leave me not, neither forsake me, O Elohim of my salvation. When my father and my mother forsake me, then Yahweh will take me up. Teach me thy way, O Yahweh, and lead me in a plain path because of my enemies. Deliver me not over under the will of my enemies, for false witnesses are risen up against me, and such as breathe out cruelty. I had fainted unless I had believed to see the goodness of Yahweh in the land of the living. Wait on Yahweh, be of good courage, and he will strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on Yahweh. Mark.
It's okay. So what is this psalm supposed to be about?
Exile and redemption.
What was that?
Exile and redemption.
Okay, good answer. Exile and redemption. In verses 2 and 3, we see the exile. Okay, where it says, when the wicked, even mine enemies and my foes, came upon me to eat up my flesh, they stumbled and fell. Though an host should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this will I be confident. Okay, we're in exile, but we're faithfully going through the exile. Okay? And in verses 4 and 6, we see the redemption. One thing have I desired of Yahweh, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of Yahweh all the days of my life, and behold the beauty of Yahweh, and to inquire in his temple. For in the time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion, in his tabernacle. In the secret of his tabernacle shall he hide me. He shall set me upon a rock. Rock, tabernacle, pavilion. All mean the same thing. Okay? Verse 5 in particular says that Yahweh will protect you and me through tribulation. And verse 6, that he will lift up our heads above our enemies. He will protect us in tribulation and then deliver us out of it. Upon a rock, in verse 6, upon a rock, that's the word tsur in Hebrew, a cliff indicates a solid monolithic rock. Reminds me of Ovadia 3, when Edom, in his pride, says, I am in the clefts of a rock. But it's not the same word for rock. Here it's Selah, a craggy rock, indicates a broken rock. Okay, so The one puts me in mind of Yahweh Yeshua, who is a sure and solid foundation, an impregnable fortress made by the creator of the universe, while the other refers to Petra, a man-made fortress that has and will again, I think, be defeated in battle. Verses 13 and 14 are what we need to take away today, though. Let's read those again, real quick-like. I had fainted unless I had believed to see the goodness of Yahweh in the land of the living. Wait on Yahweh, be of good courage, and he will strengthen thine heart. Wait, I say, on Yahweh. Verses 13 and 14, we need to believe that he will preserve us and deliver us through our trials. He always waits, in our estimation, until the last minute to redeem us and fulfill his promises to us. Is that not the absolute truth? That is the absolute truth. He is a master of drama. Okay? Because you are shaking in your boots, wondering where your deliverance is going to come from. The enemy is right there at your door. He's about to bust it down, and all of a sudden, he's taken away and you're delivered. Okay? He always waits till the last minute before he fulfills his promises to us. We need to wait on his direction and his timing. If we remain courageous through the tribulation, he will strengthen our spirits and minds and hearts and bring us through and build us up again. And so, we open it to questions and comments. Verse on actually Obadiah and the Psalm, if anybody has anything.
I'd like to comment on the Psalm. I think that this is a Psalm of Sukkot, of betrothal, actually, because it has to do, in verse 5, for in the day of evil he hides me in his booth, in his sukkah, in the covering of his tent, he hides me. And then, as a bride waits for the bridegroom, wait on Yahweh and be strong, and let him strengthen your heart. And wait, I say, wait on Yahweh. And wanting to dwell in the house of Yahweh, to be in looking upon his presence, to be in the pleasantness of him. And though we would, and still tribulation and evil that we would face, yet he will deliver us. But it just reminded me of waiting on the bridegroom to deliver us and to take us into his hiding place and being sheltered by him. Because it says, to my heart you have said, seek my face, your face, Yahweh, I seek. So we will always be watching and waiting for him, that he will be our deliverance.
Psalm 27:1, Yahweh is my light. Who is the light of the world? Yeshua. So Yeshua is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Yahweh is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? First, there's the exhortation to trust in Yeshua. When the wicked, my enemies, my foes, came up to eat my flesh, they stumbled and fell. First, we're being told that in the tribulation days that the enemies will come against Zion. They're going to fall. They're going to come against you. They're going to come against the exiles of Israel. But the promise is not that they won't come, but they will come and fall. Though a host should encamp against me, my heart will not fear. You know, that means they're after you seriously. A host. Encamp. They're after you.
You mean kind of like Esau coming against Jacob?
Yeah. In this will I be confident. Your confidence is in Yahweh. For in the time of trouble, so this is connected with tribulation, he will hide me in his pavilion in the secret of his tabernacle. Is this another scripture where it tells us that his protection is in his tabernacle, in his booth, his pavilion? So we got scriptures that we're protected in his tabernacle and his pavilion and his sukkah. And it says, he will set me upon a rock. And now is the now that we are hidden in his pavilion. Now he will, my head will be lifted up above my enemies. In other words, because I'm hidden in the pavilion, I have protection, and my head is above my enemies. And because I have deliverance from my enemies, then I offer sacrifices of joy. I sing praises to Yahweh.
I just wanted to comment on what you were just saying there, Eddie, about verses 5 and 6. And that I have trouble, speaking of tribulation, he will conceal me in his tabernacle or his sukkah. And then it goes on to say, now my head will be lifted up above my enemies around me. It's only when we humble ourselves enough, not when he humbles us, because that would be something else, but when we humble ourselves enough to put our trust in him in the most unlikely way, in the place of a sukkah, when World War III, for all intents and purposes, is breaking out all around us, then when we have humbled ourselves sufficiently, he exalts us. Right, he hides me. He conceals me. But we have to be humble enough to go in. Otherwise, we have no protection.
Okay, it says, "Hear, O Yahweh, when I cry with my voice." Who is crying? Zion. Zion cries to be delivered. "And have mercy and answer me. When you said, 'Seek my face,' my heart said, 'Thy face, Yahweh, will I seek.' Hide not your face from me." Who is he not hiding his face from? Zion. Isaiah in chapter 54 and verse 7 and 8. "For a small moment have I forsaken you, but with great mercies will I gather you. In a little wrath I hid my face from you, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on you, says Yahweh, your Redeemer. Neither forsake me, O Elohim of my salvation." This is actually a prayer to the Messiah to deliver Zion in the day of trouble. And it says, "Teach me your way and lead me in a plain path." That means follow Torah. Because Zion redeemed will follow Torah. "False witnesses have risen up against me." That means false accusations will be said against Zion, said that they're right wing, fanatical, extremists. "And I would have fainted if I believed to see the goodness of Yahweh in the land of the living." You see, unless we believe to see his goodness, we would faint in the circumstance. Unless we would believe to see his goodness, we would faint in the circumstances. And so, wait on Yahweh, and he will strengthen you. That is a biblical principle. Whenever we act in our own ability, we fall. Whenever we wait on him, we get strengthened, because we learn to trust in him.
That is exactly right. That's exactly what Jacob learned in chapter 32 today. He was walking in his own sight, and only when he humbled himself before Yahweh and then went his way, that's when he started to walk differently. That was when he started to act differently. Okay, so that makes the connection. Very good.
You brought it out, Eddie, and so did Teresa from James 4. 8 and 10, "You humble yourself in the sight of Yahweh. Resist the enemy, he will flee from you. And he will lift us up, Yahweh, in due time." Also, there's one more thing I wanted to bring out. Just looking at that verse, when Jessica was speaking about going into the tent of our husband or bridegroom, the one that says, "My father and my mother have forsaken me." Not that maybe what they've done has been all bad, but it's time to be released into the better teaching, the better way, the thing that you've grown up to be made to do.
As it said at the end of our Torah portion, in that Jacob went to the place of Sukkot, the place of booths, it was there what he recognized being in the house of his Elohim, the house of his father. The word Eben is an interesting word in that it is the Aleph, the Bet, and the Nun. And we have within that text, or within those letters, the idea of the father and of the house, the father's house. And so there is, within that father's house, within that rock, which is the meaning of Eben, rock or stone, that we have that strong place of assurance, of protection. And not only that, but there is within the Son, which is the Ben, there is within the Father, the Son, and there is that place of protection within the Father and within His Son. And just as it's mentioned in Psalms 27 here, it talks about His house. It talks about His tabernacle. And it talks about His temple. And then it talks about His tent twice. And so being in that habitation with Him is that place of security, is that place of protection, it's that place of deliverance, it's that place of rest. You know, there remains a Sabbath for the people of Elohim if they will but enter into it. And I believe it's entering into His house. Just as David was praying here in this psalm, a psalm of fearless trust in Elohim. In addition to Psalms 27, there's two other psalms that I felt were very interesting in that they mention Sukkot, and they're both mentioned twice, and they also talk about Edom and Esau. And they're Psalms 60 and Psalms 108. And in it, they repeat the same portion. It's verse 6. God has spoken in His holiness. This is Psalm 60, verse 6. God has spoken His holiness. I will exalt, I will portion out Shechem and measure out the valley of Sukkoth. Gilead is mine, and Manasseh is mine. Ephraim is also the helmet of my head, and Judah is my scepter, and Moab is my washbowl. Over Edom I throw my shoe. Shout aloud, O Philistia, because of me. Who will bring me into the besieged city, and who will lead me to Edom? And it says essentially the same thing in Psalms 108. And verse 7, it says, God has spoken in His holiness. I will exalt, I will portion out Shechem and measure out the valley of Sukkoth. Gilead is mine, Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the helmet of my head. And Judah is my scepter. Moab is my washbowl. Over Edom I shall throw my shoe. Over Philistia I shall shout aloud. And who will bring me into the besieged city? And who will lead me to Edom?
Okay, anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments on Psalm 27? Let's go to the Brit Hadashah, which is Yaakov, James, and chapter 1, verses 1 through 12. It begins with these words, James, a servant of Elohim, and of Yahweh Yeshua HaMashiach, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, greeting. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith works patience. But let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of Elohim, that gives to all men liberally and upbraids not, and it shall be given him. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering, but he that wavers is like the wave of the sea, driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he will receive anything of Yahweh. A double-minded man is unstable in all of his ways. Let your brother of low degree rejoice in that he is exalted, but the rich in that he is made low, because as the flower of the grass he shall pass away. For the sun is no sooner risen with the burning heat, but it withers the grass, and the flower thereof falls, and the grace of the fashion of it perishes. So also shall the rich man fade away in his ways. Blessed is the man that endures temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life which Yahweh has promised to them that love him. Mark.
Okay, look at verse 1. Who is he writing to? Is he writing to some Gentile church at Philippi or Ephesus or someplace like that? He's writing to the 12 tribes scattered abroad, correct? Okay. What is that? What is he talking about, the 12 tribes scattered abroad? Okay? Those are the 12 tribes of Israel in exile, and he knew where they were. You know how he knew? You know how I know he knew where they were? Because they didn't have movable type. They didn't have Xerox machines. Okay? They couldn't make multiple copies of this letter and just send them everywhere. He had to know where this letter had to be sent. He had to know what kind of route it had to take in order to get to all of the 12 tribes. He had to know that there was some place where a lot of the 12 tribes were congregated, maybe. Okay? So remember that when you're reading this thing, because that's the way it is. The book was possibly the first ever written in the Brit Hadashah. First one written after Yeshua's ascent, perhaps as early as 49 of the Common Era. Thompson's Chain Reference Bible, which is what I use as the basis for my studies, Thompson's Chain Reference Bible's book outline says that the date is arrived at because the Jerusalem Council's decree is not mentioned. That's an interesting idea. However, it's also not mentioned in any of Peter's books or any of John's books, okay, or in the book of Hebrews. So that doesn't really give you a way to date this, because those things were all written well after the Jerusalem Council. Okay, so but anyway, it is one of the earliest books written in the Scripture. Maybe the Gospel of Mark was written first. Don't know. Now, it just happens that, you know, that's a determination that was made by the early church fathers, and it's hard to get the present church fathers to not refer to them, or rather not to defer to them, because, you know, after all, they were the first and second generation from the apostles themselves, you know, so they must have been pretty straight guys, you know. Never mind that, you know, Justin Martyr and people like that were among them, and those guys were not real straight. They were okay. So anyway, do you suppose the tribulation is the theme for today? By the way, because everything that we read has something to do with tribulation. Okay, here we go in James. We have faith tests brings patience building. Okay, are you listening? If you are enduring trouble and you stay fixed on Yahweh Yeshua, you will gain patience, or the ability to wait on Yahweh for His timing in your life. But if you say you're waiting on Yahweh and then act without His counsel, if you say you trust His atonement and then go and offer trespass offerings at the altar like the Hebrews were planning to do, if you say that you love Yahweh and then mistreat the least able to protect themselves, the widows, orphans, and Levites, you are double-minded, driven of the waves and tossed, and bound to not receive the blessings of Yahweh that you expect. In verses 9 through 12, those are about rich men who trust in their riches instead of Yahweh Yeshua, which is an extension of the lessons being taught in verses 1 through 8. The rich man who believes will have no endurance, or rather, I'm sorry, will have to endure the same type of tribulation as the poor schlubs, spiritually speaking. He may not have to beg for his food, but he will be brought low and have to trust Yahweh for something. How he endures, whether he tries to bail himself out with his money or his power, or whether he waits for Yahweh's timing, that will determine if he truly trusts Yeshua or not. Usually, it takes longer for the rich man to give it all up to Yahweh than for the poor, because the poor has a shorter way to go before they reach bottom, you know, economically at least. That's why the first beatitude has to do with the poor in spirit. The poor have to trust Yahweh daily, hourly, minutely, for their sustenance. So the drop is not so far. The rich man, on the other hand, has a long way to fall before he hits bottom, unless he is poor in spirit. If he's poor in his spirit, then he's ready to wait on Yahweh. Okay? He's more spiritually aware of his need, spiritually, no matter how sumptuously he lives. Soon he will see the disparity between him and the poor brethren, and he will give of his substance, and perhaps later his time and talents, to relieve the suffering of his brethren. That's where I had to quit, because I was starting to ramble, as you can see, and so leave that open. Well, I'm open to questions and comments now. It was 11:30 by this time, and I was very tired.
James chapter 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it joy. Didn't say it is joy. It says count it as joy. The way you stand on Yahweh's word and receive the 30, 60, 100-fold blessing is in and through tribulation. You stand on His word and you count it joy, because your eyes are looking at the victory rather than the current circumstances. Because we're told in Yeshua's parable of the sower that sows the word, that the sower sows the word, that's what happens first, then affliction and persecution arises for the word's sake. There is an attack on Yahweh's word. And Yahweh permits an attack on his word so that Yahweh can prove that his word is true. So when the attack comes on his word, you are to count it joy, or you to stand on his word. Because you cannot count it joy unless you know. Count it all joy knowing. Count it all joy knowing. That the trying of your faith, how is your faith tried? When you sow the word, affliction and persecution arises for the word's sake. You count it joy knowing that the trying of your faith works patience. Let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. That verse expresses attitude. When it says, let patience have her perfect work, what it means is to stay consistent and constant. Be even keel. Don't get upset by the circumstances. Don't let them drive you and overtake you. Keep your eye focused on the promise, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. So my attitude is, you see, the reason why we get upset about our circumstances is because we care. It's because we care. And so, in order to combat getting upset because of your circumstances, you have to have the attitude of not wanting anything. In other words, you don't care. You have to have the attitude of you don't care, even though you truly care. That's why you're counting it joy. It is where you are taking the attitude of I'm consistent. I'm not going to allow my love for what I want to see fulfilled in my life consume my moment, so that I lose focus on the promise. But my attitude is I'm wanting nothing. In other words, my attitude is I am not allowing the circumstances to consume my mind and my thought and my emotions. And so it says, if anyone lack wisdom, what's wisdom? Wisdom is following Torah. Let him ask of Elohim, that gives all men liberally and upbraids not, and it shall be given him. But let him ask in faith. And it says, don't be double-minded. Well, from my belief, from my perception, what was Jacob? I think he was double-minded. He prayed and asked for Yahweh's promises, but then he completely gave in and said, you know, Esau, I love you. What do you want? I'll give you this. I'll give you that. You know, I love you. You know, bye. Leave me alone. Oh, good. Got by that one. He was double-minded. And so, then the next thing we need to understand is verse 12. Blessed is the man that endures temptation. Because, see, you cannot be an overcomer unless there is something to overcome. The overcoming is the trial, the affliction, the persecution, and the temptation. And there is a crown for people that overcome. There is a reward for those that overcome. Anybody have further thoughts, questions, comments? Mark?
In verse 4, yeah, I'm just, as you're going through all that, I'm looking at something. I see the words, it says, you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. It says the same thing three times, is what it looks like to me. But I looked at the difference in the words, and perfect is from the word teleos, which is kind of the same thing as tamim.
It is the same.
Okay, and it means absolute completeness. It's telos is the root, and it's teleos has just got a different ending. It's pretty much that's it. But the word entire also translates as complete, whole. But if you look, there are two roots that are here. So I look at both roots, and I see holos, which means all, complete, okay? And then I look at kleros, which is not a root word itself. The root beneath it is klea, or klaa. And that means to break. So it looks like this is a complete break from something. So you have, you're perfect, you are complete, total, because you've made a complete break from something else. And you're now wanting nothing. Okay, you have no need. So there is a progression here. You have broken completely away from your old life. You have gone completely after your new life, and now you have no need whatsoever. Your needs are all taken care of by the one whom you're following, Yahweh. That's the way I read that particular thing there. Anyway, it's just something that came up. So.
You know what, Tom? You follow a pattern week after week after week. You be quiet for the whole Midrash. At the very end, you come up and share all your wisdom.
It's interesting how this is learned by experience. It's not just book knowledge. We learn this by experience.
That's right.
And I was considering how this is just absolutely the opposite of the worldly wisdom. You know, like in verse 3 or 2, the world would say, complain more loudly, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. It is just so
sue somebody
opposed to the way we're taught to think in America.
As Mark was talking earlier about these words here for perfect and complete in the Greek and what they may really mean. And then it says, lacking nothing. You know, and James is talking to those who have been dispersed across the world. And he says, you know, when you go through these trials, these tests, these temptations, whatever word your version has in there, when you go through tribulation and persecution, basically, consider it joy. And then he says, the end result is that you're perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And Eddie, you used a good phrase earlier that made me think of this other verse that I'm turning to, is that it's the attitude. We choose our attitude and we choose how we are going to respond to something. That's always in our power. And Paul, in writing to the Philippians, talks about who he is. But he says, but. In other words, I have all of this, but. Whatever things were a gain to me, those things I have counted as loss for the sake of Messiah. More than that, I count all things to be lost. In other words, once we get to the realize that we have nothing and we need nothing, I lack nothing. Why? Because I have Him. More than that, I call all things lost in view of the surpassing value of knowing Messiah Yeshua, my Yahweh, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and count them but rubbish so that I may gain Messiah and may be found in Him. Not having a righteousness of my own derived from law, but that which is through faith in Messiah, the righteousness which comes from God on the basis of faith, that, here's the reason that we're to get that attitude that you were talking about, that we should choose how we should respond. In order that, it literally says, that, verse 10, Philippians 3:10, I may know Him. Why do I lack nothing? Because it's that I may know Him. And the power of His resurrection, and this is the hard one for us as Americans, the fellowship of His sufferings. You know, that's why, in my mind, the whole pre-trib rapture lie came about, because we didn't want to suffer anymore. But He says we should be rejoicing in these things, that we're supposed to desire to know Him and the power of His resurrection and the fellowship of His sufferings, being even conformed to His death. In order that I may attain to the resurrection from the dead. Do we want to retain to the resurrection from the dead? That's my goal should I die before he comes. To be resurrected in him, then I need to know him, the power of his resurrection, the fellowship of his sufferings, and if it means death, being conformed to his death, not mine. That's the attitude we need to choose.
One day I was groaning, murmuring in my heart, my mind about, oh, why do I got to go through this? Oh, why do I got to go through that? And I realized one day that we are called to be conformed to his image and his sufferings. And then I realized, wait a second, the greatest blessing that he could give me and the greatest love that he could show me is if I go through the sufferings of Messiah. Because if I die with him, I'll be raised with him. And I went from, you want to escape suffering, to, you know, if we're honest, nobody will welcome a suffering. No one says, hey, I want to suffer tomorrow. But realizing, though, that when those sufferings come, that it is a blessing from him that we have an opportunity to take of the fellowship of Messiah's sufferings. And so that, I got to find the verse. Paul said, you know, whatever state I am, I end up being content. And that is being in that state of where it says in James that you may be perfect. That place of spiritual maturity is that you're content when things go well and you can deal with things going bad. You know, sometimes when things don't go as against how I would like to see them go, I've thought the thought, you know, life isn't too bad. I'm able to eat. I'm able to breathe. I got a place to sleep. You know, life's not that bad, so who cares? You know, it's okay. Did I interrupt you? I think I did.
No, not at all. I just wanted to go on what the verse, by the way, Mark looked it up. It's Philippians 4:11. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. And when you get that place, and it's a long journey, I don't think I've gotten there. In fact, I'm fairly certain I haven't gotten there yet. When we learn what Paul learned, to be content no matter what, and then we realize what you realized the day when you were moaning and groaning, which we've all done. But then you start thinking, wait a minute. He's finding me worthy enough to endure suffering as he did. He's counted me worthy enough. That's when we can get to what James says, consider it joy.
You got it.
That's the only way, is when we realize it's because of him.
Right.
That I'm being persecuted. It's because of him I'm going through this trial. It's because of him, because he counts me worthy. Not because of anything I've done or who I am, but because of him. Then we can count it joy.
Jacob, as an example to us, was being perfected and complete. That when you talked about that word complete, Eddie, or someone did here, of it being that we are cut off from something that doesn't belong in our life anymore. Jacob was being trained to do that, even if it looked like he was dragging his feet. And so that's what we are going through, even if it's taking time. We are being trained.
And this is the walk that we're called to do, that most Christians don't realize that this is the walk, and therefore the only thing that appeals to them is believing in Messiah is good fire insurance. And it's a benefit to me because you need this fire insurance.
But ultimately, when we understand Scripture, it's not fire insurance, because we must walk through the fire insurance to be purified and have the dross removed from our lives.
They view it as it's saving me from going to H-E double hockey sticks. And so that I'm blessed. And they don't realize that there is a price to pay for walking the walk.
Isaiah 43:2-3, when you pass through the waters, I am with you, and through rivers they do not overflow you. When you walk through fire, you are not scorched, and a flame does not burn you. For I am Yahweh your Elohim, the set-apart one of Israel, your Savior. I gave Mitzrayim for your ransom, Cush and Seba in your place.
Mark, you have a comment?
Okay. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. I was just that when you said H-E double hockey sticks, you know, we had four different people in here go, oh, and one's a man, I haven't heard that in a long time. It reminded me of an old episode of Night Court, in which the public defender, who was a this girl was so righteous and upright, you know, she couldn't even say a bad word. Anyway, she said something happened, and she said, "Oh, darn it all to heck." And, you know, that was a real funny line, you know, on a TV show, you know. And so that's that. I'm sorry, I digress. Oh,
well,
darn it
did,
all the heck.
You did say I'm getting tired and beginning to ramble. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the point out of suffering. And, it's something so great and so wonderful to suffer, as we've made out the point. Not for the present, but living for the future, and you don't have to even focus on your suffering, because when you get to live when you're focusing on the future, yeah, this doesn't matter. This is so I can be tried, and then it's all striving for the end point. So you don't even have to focus on your suffering. You can say, you know what, this doesn't matter, because I get to reap great reward in the end. So,
anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments? We're in James chapter 1, verses 1-12. Anyone in the congregation or in Pawtucket Land have any thoughts, questions, comments? Does anybody else have anything that they'd like to share? Well, if such is the case, we're no run.
Well, I don't want to.
You got it right before we close.
I want
the
to
gate.
Go back to your. Can we go back to your yeshiva teaching a little bit?
My what?
The yeshiva teaching?
The yeshiva teaching. You mean the Yeshua T teaching?
Yeshua teaching.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. All right. Now, if we have Zion, once again, in the land, now there's this revolt that's coming up because they're standing against those that are dividing of the land, so there's this pressure that's coming upon the land and upon these people that are there. And they're the ones, you say, that are primarily the Jewish people. Then, if that's the case, and then they call for a coming together, then what happens in regards to Ezekiel 38, where there's an invasion of the land, and it talks about how they're going to flee into the wilderness, and yet it talks about on the mountains of Israel. Who's going to be the ones that are there in Ezekiel 38 that are living securely, all of them? It says in verse 8 of chapter 38, and it says, "You will go up and you will come like a storm. You will be like a cloud covering the land, you and all your troops and your many peoples with you."
Well, you have a type fulfillment during tribulation days and an ultimate fulfillment at the end of the Messianic era, Revelation chapter 20.
Okay, she's saying that.
So therefore, it may not have to be that every part of Ezekiel 38 and 39 gets fulfilled here in this generation, because the ultimate fulfillment is Revelation chapter 20 at the end of the Messianic era, when they beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks, and there's been no exile, and there's no nations that come against Israel. They're dwelling safely and securely. That's the ultimate fulfulfillment.
Are you saying that this chapters 38 and 39 does not take place during the time of tribulation, during the time of
I believe
of
in part it does. I believe in part it does, and because it says they come upon the mountains of Israel, and that is where Zion has got to declare their state, upon the mountains of Israel. So they're going to attack them upon the mountains of Israel for declaring the state, and also to enforce the peace agreement, which will be kicking Jews from their homes.
Oh, hang on a second. Now, is this going to be before Ephraim is gathered together with those that are in revolt, or is this going to be after that?
Well, you're talking about gathering. They're going to be united in heart first.
No, I'm talking about in the land, Eddie. I'm talking about those that are gathered in the land.
Ultimately, when
there's an ultimate army, when there's
ultimately
an army that
comes upon them. When the return takes back into the land, it's going to be at the very end of the tribulation. Messiah's got to be ready to set his feet down on the Mount of Olives.
So you're saying that they're all gathered together there? All the Ephraim.
But during Gog and Magog? I mean, 38 and 38 and 9?
In 38 and 39, the part that refers to the time of tribulation, not talking about what will happen at the end of the millennial period, but referring to what is happening during the time of tribulation, talking about those that are gathered together in the land on the mountains of Israel during the time of the revolt against the dividing of the land, well, then they leave and flee into the wilderness and then come back to the mountains of Israel and then be invaded then by this northern army.
Well, I believe the timing of Ezekiel 38 and 39 is shortly after declaring the state, before Ephraim returns back to the land to unite with Judah.
So you see, before then, actually, they returned to the land as far as...
Gog and Magog is quickly after the declaration of the state to destroy the forces that are declaring the state and to kick Jews out of their homes, which happens before Ephraim returning to the land.
Okay, that's what I was thought. All right, that's good. Thank you for answering that. All right.
All end time prophecies, as far as I can tell. I've been studying these things for 25 years, and it just seems to me that all end-time prophecies have at least three fulfillments, okay? And it goes like this in Ecclesiastes 1:9. The thing that has been is that which shall be, and that which is done now is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. The idea being that this is the three different fulfillments, past, present, future. The initial fulfillment of the thing, like Antiochus Epiphanes, I think was the initial fulfillment of the anti-Messiah. Mm-hmm. Then along comes Titus, and he makes it that much worse. And then along comes Diocletian, who made it that much worse. And it goes on and on, and there are more and more. And then at the end of days...
Nero.
Nero was one of them. Then at the end of days, we have the ultimate fulfillment of that thing. Now, each fulfillment is more intense, and it's harder on the people who are having the stuff happen to them. So this is the same thing with Ezekiel 38:39. I believe that that exact thing happened very shortly after Ezekiel said it. Then there was, and I believe that is the Assyrians coming in and doing what they did. Then we're going.
If you're going to talk. Wait.
Go ahead.
Ezekiel was in the land of Shinar. He was there
Babylon.
Serving under the.
He was in Babylon.
He was in Babylon, around Babylon area. That's right, in the land of Shinar. And so that was after the Assyrians had been already destroyed and devastated by the Babylonians. And so it was after all the invasions had already taken place. They had already been removed from the land. It was just before, you know, the return
Ezekiel
to the land.
Ezekiel is the guy that prophesied the
right.
365 years of Israel's exile, and then 40 years of Judah's exile.
Right.
And okay, so but that was
the
prophecy
taken...
that he was giving the warning to both of those things. So Ezekiel didn't happen while he was in Assyria.
The invasions had already taken place. There was no more invasions other than what took place under Alexander and what happened under the Seleucids and the Ptolemies.
Ezekiel was not in the land when the kings were there. Is that what we're saying?
The Assyrians had already been devastated by the time that Ezekiel was carrying out his ministry and giving his prophetic word. It was referring to if you could say, of any invasion from the north, it would have been the Seleucids that came down after the time of Alexander's invasion.
Okay, could be that. Could be that, because I'm not clear on the history right now in my head. However, all end-time prophecies do have numerous fulfillments. Okay? The ultimate fulfillment of Ezekiel 38:39 will be at the end of the tribulation, or at the end of the millennium, rather. There will be a partial fulfillment of it, and all of the fulfillments going up to the ultimate are partial fulfillments. Okay? And, because the ultimate one is that's it. That's the one that he's ultimately talking about. So, yeah, there has been a fulfillment of 38:39. There will be a fulfillment of 38:39 in the very near future, and I personally think that's going to be us and coming as Assyria, okay? And then the ultimate thing will be when Satan is released at the end of the millennium, and he gathers all of the people of the earth other than the remnant.
So you're saying Gog and Magog are Assyria and...
I believe that it says that they're the king of the north.
Assyria and...
That's... Assyria came from the north, and they came around from the north and attacked. Babylon came from the east and attacked and carried them off to the east.
So it's Assyria and Babylon, essentially? Is Gog and Magog?
No, Gog and Magog are... Actually, I think maybe George might be one of them. So that's a personal thing. George Bush, I mean.
Okay. Any other thoughts, questions, comments? Any other thoughts, questions, comments regarding our discussions, James chapter 1, or any other? Okay, going once, going twice. Oh. Gone. You've just been gonged to end the Midrash. So we pray that it's been a blessing to you all. And until we do it again, Shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.